Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Sunday, October 12, 2014. Thank you for joining us tonight. We're coming to you on a pre-recorded format and have been for several weeks. And of course, since we are no longer live, we no longer take callers. But I appreciate all of the comments that many of you have been making on my Facebook page and at my website, carolynbaker.net. And I invite you to continue doing that. And also feel free to ask questions as well. You know, tomorrow in the United States, many people are celebrating Columbus Day. I can't personally believe that people are still celebrating one of the foremost pillagers of indigenous people in the history of the human race, but they are. And even though modern indigenous groups protest the celebrations mightily, they still happen. On these occasions, we have to stop and honor indigenous peoples for their resilience, perseverance, and the ability of their cultures and traditions to survive and even thrive in many parts of the world today. So tonight's show is very well timed because we're going to talk about what we can learn from indigenous cultures that have collapsed. And I thank you for joining us for this anti-Columbus Day show. As some of you know, for the last few weeks, I've been announcing a tour that my friends Gary Stamper and Anya McAndrew and I are leading to the Yucatan Peninsula in February 2015. We're calling this tour The Indigenous Heart, Reconnecting with the Timeless in an Era of Endings. I've been directing you to a specific Facebook page for the tour and to my website, but tonight I have Gary and Anya with me to talk about not just the tour, but why we're doing it and why we feel it's important to learn about cultures that have reached a very high point of development and then collapsed. Even if you're not able to join us in February in the Yucatan Peninsula, I think you'll want to hear what we have to share this evening about what we can learn from collapsed cultures. We don't just want to talk about the logistics of the tour, but we want to slow this event down and kind of put it under a microscope so that we can appreciate the significance of such a tour. And very importantly, so that we can appreciate the richness of anything we can learn about how and why cultures collapse. The three of us want to learn as much as possible from Mayan culture and utilize what we learn to help us navigate the collapse of industrial civilization and the repercussions of catastrophic climate change. We want all of you to know more about the people who are guiding this tour because we aren't playing the role of tour guides. We're learning along with everyone else who's joining us. So knowing more about who we are and the work we do may give you more of a sense of the tour than anything we can advertise about it. So I also want to clarify that although Gary and Anya and I have our own work in the world, this trip isn't going to be about promoting our work. We're going to provide some samples of our work during the tour, but mostly this is an opportunity to feel the power of the ancient Mayan culture and how it still reverberates through the Yucatan, the people, the land, and the animals of the region. The trip is not going to be about attending an 8-day workshop. Each of us will make a brief presentation of our work, but the tour has been structured to provide learning about the land, the people, and the culture, having lots of time to relax and restore our souls, and of course, making connections with other members of the tour with whom we share the tour's intention. Personally, I'm very excited to connect with people who are passionate about Mayan culture and its timeless wisdom and how we can learn from a collapsed civilization. I'm also looking forward to connecting with people who get it about collapse and understand that our culture is following a similar trajectory as the Maya did so many centuries ago. So let's begin with Gary Stamper. Gary, I've known you since you attended one of my workshops in Northern California in, I believe, 2011, and we've been on the same wavelength since then. You started the Collapsing into Consciousness website, and you were on this show at one point when I was sitting in for Mike. You're the author of Awakening the New Masculine, The Path of the Integral Warrior, and you've been facilitating workshops for men for a long time. You have two websites, which are GaryStamper.com and CollapsingIntoConsciousness.com. Your partner is psychotherapist and shamanic astrologer Anya McAndrew, whom we're going to speak with in a moment. And one of the things I know that you're passionate about is gender equity and the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine in men and women. So I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about gender equality in egalitarian indigenous cultures and how that might relate to a deeper exploration of Mayan culture.
Sure, I can. Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's great to be on your show again. It's great to be talking with you again. And of course, we've been talking for quite a while as we have been constructing the tour that we're going on in February, but it's always great to speak with you. So, yeah, the concept of men and women, the sacred masculine, sacred feminine in indigenous cultures, and I love that you use the word egalitarian indigenous cultures, because when we think in our postmodern culture, when we think of egalitarian, sometimes we think of new age ideas that are equally balanced, and in some ways these indigenous cultures were, but a lot of people have the mistaken idea that these were primarily matriarchal based cultures, and while women played a huge role and perhaps even a leading role in these cultures, as they did in Native American cultures here in the United States, where we had the Council of Grandmothers who actually elected the chief. And the chief could do what he wanted, but the Council of Grandmothers could remove the chief in a lot of these tribes. And so there was an equal sharing of power in that manner, but not in a new age way of, you know, being perfectly balanced, you know, with equal amounts of everything. Men and women and masculine and feminine had specific roles that they carried out that they were better suited. And for a lot of these indigenous cultures, it was decided by these cultures that the women, the feminine, was better suited to make judgments about whether to go to war, what the tribe should do, and then to have the chief be the one who carries those functions out. And so they were egalitarian, but it was really a matter of shared power between the two and not in the way we generally think of egalitarian cultures. So today, the idea of gender equality and sacred masculine, the sacred feminine in men and women, has come around to a point where we think we have to have equal portions of each. And one of the things that I talk about in my work is it's not about balancing them equally within us. It's really about mastering each of the feminine, mastering both the feminine and the masculine qualities within each one of us, and then being able to move to the appropriate essence when it's necessary, and when it's needed, and when it just feels good. And so it's a little bit of a different approach, and I think that that's as we begin to move into later stage consciousness, what I'm referring to as a later stage tribal consciousness, we're beginning to move back into these tribes at later stages, and that is, I think, one of the paths that we can really count on, because that's what really getting local is all about, is moving into these indigenous egalitarian tribes where the power is shared.
Very good. Thank you for that beautiful explanation. That's very, very clear and succinct and very thorough. Also, I'm really interested in knowing what you think we can learn from indigenous cultures. You say there's a formula, so please expand on this.
Sure. And, you know, the formula may not be exactly the right word, but we know from works like Jared Diamond's Collapse, his book Collapse, that cultures and societies go through pretty much the same kind of processes, regardless of how they collapse. And while how cultures collapse can be different, the process and what happens is pretty much the same. We've seen that in the classic Maya, where we're going to be going in the Yucatan. We've seen it in the Easter Islanders. We've seen it with the Anasazi, the Fertile Crescent Society, Iraq and Iran in that area, Angkor Wat, and the Great Zimbabwe, and all these different places. And within the last decade or two, we began to be studying to know that archaeologists have shown us that there were a lot of environmental problems underlying a lot of these past collapses. But what we've also discovered and realized is that not all cultures, particularly in the East, collapsed in the same way. And so that there are different ways that cultures collapse. You know, some of the societies have been more fragile than others. So if we can understand what makes some societies more fragile than other societies, then we can learn more about our own situation. So there are some societies that have already collapsed today. And, you know, like Somalia and Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, there are also societies today that are close to collapse, you know, like Nepal, Indonesia, and Colombia, that, you know, things are going pretty rough. And that can be a forebearer of what we're going to be going through. So the obvious question with this tour going to the Yucatan is, what can we learn from the past that would help us avoid declining or collapsing in the way that so many past cultures and societies have? And that's a complex answer, because there's a lot of different reasons why cultures collapse. But and we're lucky in that we're close enough to this, to the Yucatan, where we can get there fairly easily. We can really study it. In fact, it's really interesting that we have people from all over the world coming to our workshop, not our workshop, but our tour in February. We have people from Germany, from England, from Australia, so they're coming from all over. And we're very excited that even 4 months out, that we're already half full on this workshop, so that portends well for a full tour. So Jed Diamond, in his book Collapse, talks about a five-point framework, a checklist of things that we can look at, and let's just go through those really quick, and we'll see how that applies to our modern-day culture, because what's different about what's going on today is we're not just talking about one society collapsing, we're talking about collapse on a global level.
Right.
And this is the first time that we've actually come up against that in our history. And so the first item on Diamond's framework is to look for human impacts on the environment. And that is where people inadvertently destroy the resource base on which they depend. And we can see that all over the world. And the second, I'll just go through these fairly fast, but the second item on his checklist is climate change. Sound familiar? Climate can get warmer or colder or drier or wetter, obviously, and it happens all the time. But this is the first time that we have 97% of all scientists on the planet who are working with climate change saying this is directly human caused. This is not a matter of what is going on the planet, which is a normal cycle of things that happens over thousands of years, but it is something that we are contributing to, and we don't know. I mean, we could stop it, but it would basically mean the end of industrial civilization, putting an end to that, and that kind of results in the same thing as if we were to collapse through it. So the big question there is, well, how do we move around it? And so the third thing on Diamond's checklist is relations with neighboring or friendly societies or unfriendly societies that may prop us up. You know, who do we trade with? Where do we get stuff? Where does it come from? And again, for the first time in our history over the last 300 years, we got products come to us from all over the world. We're dependent on this entire global network of transportation and oil and gasoline and all these different things to get products. You know, in the normal American supermarket, every piece of food on average in every supermarket comes an average of 1,500 miles away. So unless you're buying locally, that's how you're buying your food. And that depends on that crop up from other cultures, other neighborhoods, other states, and other nations. And then Diamond's fourth item is relations with hostile societies. And that is, you know, how are you getting along? You know, what wars are you involved in? As we're sitting here right now today with five or six wars going on and more happening all the time. And some of us believing that one of the reasons we're involved in these wars is because they're great profit centers for the corporate elite that, you know, are in charge of a lot of things. And so there's a fourth thing that we can look and see what's going on. It tells us a lot about where we are today. And then Diamond talks about also the fifth item historically is the political, economic, social, and cultural factors in the society that make it more or less likely that the society will perceive and solve its environmental problems or its problems between the rich and the poor and the elite and the not-so-elite. And so in modern society, for instance, we now know that that the cultural elite are basically working off of a profit motive that has no consideration whatsoever for other people or what tomorrow might bring. And that's not a good sign. And we know that each one of these things played a role in the failure of past cultures and societies. And here we are today sitting right smack dab in the middle of every one of those things happening to us all at the same time.
Thank you so much for that really thorough explanation. And there are so many dots we can connect with Mayan culture, of course. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I'm wondering if you could explain, Gary, the proposed schedule of this tour and what we'll be doing and seeing.
Sure, you bet. I don't remember exactly how we decided we were going to move into this, but I remember all of a sudden it seemed like we were having a conversation that said, wouldn't it be great if?
Right.
and then we just kind of went from there, and I started looking around and seeing what was available and what we might do, and everything just kept falling into place. It was really amazing.
Yeah, it was. Beautiful.
What we've done is we've planned a 9-night, 10-day tour, what I'm calling 9 magical nights and 10 amazing days. And we're going to be flying into Cancun on the first day on February 6th. And at that point, we're all going to meet at the airport. Some are flying in a day earlier, a couple days earlier. We're all going to meet at the airport, and we're going to jump on an air-conditioned modern bus that's going to take us 3 hours into the inland of the Yucatan to this amazing, beautiful bed and breakfast in Yucatan in Itzamal called Makanche Bed and Breakfast. And they're large enough to hold all 30 of us, which is pretty rare. And we're primarily, if we fill this up, we're primarily going to be taking this over, which is our goal. And Itzamal in the middle of the Yucatan jungle is an ancient city that has ruins right in it, and it's a colonial city with a lot of colonial buildings and ancient structures as well. So it's going to be very interesting. We're going to be able to walk through that town and see the different things there. And this is an all-inclusive trip, which means that all of our meals and everything are included, and all the tours are included. The only thing that people will be on their own about is primarily their lunches, because we're going to be eating out on most of these tours, and that would be two that we don't know where we're going to be eating. We're not sure, you know, how the days are going to go. We're going to maintain some flexibility, and so we're going to be paying for our own lunches while we're out. But other than that, it's pretty much all-inclusive. But we've got a great schedule. So the first day that we're in, full day that we're actually there, we're going to be going to Chichen Itza. And Chichen Itza is now called one of the new seven wonders of the world, and it's one of the largest Mayan cities. And these northern Yucatan cities were the last cities to collapse in the Yucatan, in the Mayan culture. And the initial collapse in the lower Yucatan in Central America began about 600-700 years earlier. But while that was collapsing, these new structures in the north were still being built. And so the collapse is really divided into two sections, the early Mayan collapse and the later Mayan collapse. So we're going to be having, and I don't know if any of our listeners have been to Chichen Itza or not before, but Anya and I have been there before. It's pretty touristy to a large degree, but it's really worthwhile just in the sense of, you get a sense of how immense the city was and these structures. And of course, you can't climb to the pyramids like you used to, because unfortunately people were defacing things on it and they closed those off. But you still get a sense of what this is like. And then we're going to be coming back having lunch out, and then we'll have pretty much all day there. We'll return to our hotel and the dinner in the evening, and we'll have a free evening where we're going to be talking about what we're doing. On day three, the third day, we're going to tour the Aki ruins. And this is a settlement that's fairly close to where we're going to be staying that is also has Mayan and Toltec influences. And those were two different groups of people. And the Toltecs also had a huge influence on the last place that we'll be visiting, Tulum, which is a seaport on the seventh day, and which is also a beautiful place. All of these are amazing structures, and we're going to get a sense of all of this. And we have our own personal guide who's going to be traveling with us, who is a specialist in Mayan plant medicine and ceremonies and those kinds of things, and really knows the area well. He is also a tour guide, but he won't be the primary tour guide that we're using as we go to these individual places. We're also including the tour guides from those places in our all-inclusive. And then day four, we're going to have an unguided tour of the colonial city of Izamal, where our hotel is located. And it's one of two really magical cities in the Yucatan because they are ancient cities, both in the idea that there are ruins there and that there are also colonial buildings and some modern buildings as well. So it's pretty cool. We'll have a free day doing that. We can kind of tour as we want to. And then every night, we're going to have what we're calling the conversation salon. And you can join in those if you want to. We're going to be talking about what the impact of these things were on us, what we learned, what we bring back together, what can we learn from this, et cetera, et cetera. Day five, which I think is going to be one of the best days for everybody, is we are going to be doing a tour and swims in the cenotes. And if for people who don't know what cenotes are, we're going to be visiting three beautiful underground rivers found only in the Yucatan and Florida and Cuba. On the entire world, this is the only place you see these. Instead of above-ground rivers in these locations, there are underground rivers, and there are these beautiful caves that you can swim in with these amazing waters. And on the website, you can see photos of those. And we're going to spend most of the day doing that. And then we have, in the afternoon, we have a planned event that we're going to talk about a little later on with Anya. And then we're going to do some journey processing after that. We'll have our evening conversation salon again probably too. And then day six, we're going to take a trip north on our bus up to the Caribbean shoreline on the north end of the Yucatan. And we're going to be visiting a quaint little fishing village that's reputed to be the burial site of the notorious pirate Jean Lafitte. And we'll have lunch out, and then we're going to do a highly rated trip down on the riverboat tour of the mangroves. And there are flamingos, a cenote there are crocodiles, a freshwater stream flowing in the middle of the Caribbean. And it's just supposedly absolutely beautiful, and we're really looking forward to that, too. And then day seven, you're going to be talking in the morning session about your book, Collapsing Consciously.
Right.
And provide some exercises and stuff like that. We'll have lunch in Izamal, and we'll have remainder of the day free where we can relax, swim, get a massage, you know, go into meditation, whatever we want to do, reflection. We can visit Izamal again, hang out, meditate, take a nap in a hammock, swim in this beautiful pool at our hotel, whatever we want to do, and just kind of relax. And then day eight is the last day that we're going to be checking out. We're going to be checking out of that hotel. And we'll be taking a three-hour bus ride back to the east coast of Yucatan to the beautiful coastal Tulum, a Maya seaport, where the ruins preside over this amazing rugged coastline. And we're going to have lunch out there. We're going to be able to swim on the strip of this brilliant beach that's there and these beautiful green turquoise water at the ruins that will just absolutely, I think, leave people floored with their beauty. And from there, we head up to Cancun, where we'll spend the last two nights of our journey at this beautiful older hotel that's been remodeled. It's really quaint. And Anya and I visited this hotel a couple months ago when we were in Cancun, and it really is charming and nice. And it's Hotel Dos Playas. It's right on the beach, and we've negotiated a special two-day all-inclusive price for our tour. And we're going to dine in Cancun, enjoy the nightlife, and wake up on the beach for day nine, when we're going to be going into, this will be our last full day on the tour, and we're going to ferry over from Cancun over to Isla Mujeres, which is called the Island of Women, where we'll take golf carts to the ruins that served as the sanctuary for the goddess Ixchel. And she's the Mayan moon goddess, and Anya will tell you more about that, and is also associated with fertility, reason, medicine, and happiness. And we're going to go over there because when we were there about 2 months ago, we were asking people, how did this get its name? And we kept hearing different stories, and we determined that nobody there really understood why the island got its name. And it wasn't until I got back and did some research on the internet that I discovered is that the Spaniards, when they landed, that was the first place they landed when they came. And when they got there, they saw all these statues of women all over the island, because this was a place that people came to from the Yucatan and paddled over, came over and visited as the site of Ixchel, the goddess of the moon goddess. And so, so they named it the women. And so, and then they proceeded to tear down all of the statues because it conflicted with their religion, of course, and, you know, which is the story of all that goes. But there, I'm going to let Anya tell you a little bit about what we're going to do as far as ceremony goes. And then we have our last night in Cancun on day 10. We leave Cancun for home, or some people are going to be staying. We're going to stay a couple extra days. Another 6 people that are coming are going to be staying a few extra days, and we're going to just enjoy a little downtime on there. So that's basically a quick oversight of what we're doing. And we have planned a trip that is both really interesting and also can be relaxing and reflective and have plenty of time to really think about and talk about what we're staying.
Okay, Gary, so can you tell us how people learn more and register?
Oh, absolutely, sure. They can go to the website, it's fullmoonsanctuary.org. That is our website for our church. And then they go to, they'll see a link there that take them to the Yucatan 2015 trip. So fullmoonsanctuary.org, and just follow the link on the left to the trip page. And it has all the information with photos and how to get there, how they can save money on their booking their flights, and a whole bunch of other things that's there. And then from there, they can contact me, and I can walk them through the registration process.
Thank you so much for all of that. And, you know, this is getting so juicy, and I'm loving the conversation, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time. So we're going to forego the songs that I was going to have us play today, because I want to make sure Anya has plenty of time, and then I have some remarks also. This is the Lifeboat Hour, and I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. We're talking about the Indigenous heart reconnecting with the timeless in an era of endings. We're talking about what we can learn from other cultures that have collapsed. And we're going to be, Gary, Anya, and I are going to be taking this journey to the Yucatan Peninsula in February to learn more about this. So Anya McAndrew is a shamanic astrologer, which I find is a fascinating topic that I could ask her questions about for hours. Yeah. But right now, I have just a couple of questions that I want to ask her. And I'd like her to answer for our listeners, but first I want to share a bit about Anya. She's a psychotherapist. She has been initiating women into personal and spiritual empowerment for decades. And with Gary, she resides in a shamanic retreat community in the Smoky Mountains in western North Carolina. Her website is goddessontheloose.com, goddessontheloose.com. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Anya.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you so much for having us.
You bet. And first of all, what is shamanic astrology, and how can it serve us at this turbulent time in human history?
Well, you know, shamanic astrology is a little bit different than traditional astrology, in that we really honor what we call the as above, so below, as within, so without mystery. So we actually feel that the patterns of the constellations and the cycles of the sun and the moon and the planets are the same thing as the patterns and cycles of the human psyche and the seasons of our lives. So right. So that's the as above, so below, as within, so without. And it's we consider it to be literal. And that's, you know, one of the principles. So it's not a relationship of cause and effect. It is the same thing. And so we see that our astrological chart, or the exact time that we were born, which is a picture of the sky, is actually our geometrical, the geometrical pattern of our own psyche. So that's one of the principles.
Mm-hmm.
And we also perceive, you know, shamanic astrology to be earth-centered and experiential. So we're very much sky watchers, and we don't use telescopes or cybernetic enhancement of any kind. We're looking at what's there in the sky as the ancient peoples, the terrestrial humans that, that experienced the sky, the Neo-Ptolemic peoples, also experience the sky without any aided vision and without light pollution. So shamanic astrology, you know, many astrologers don't know the night sky. It's not, it, I have to put a caveat in here that the night sky is not my area of expertise, but I have learned it several times, as a matter of fact, and it's fascinating. So astrologers don't actually even look at the sky. You know, it's all an internal thing. But we do a lot of our ceremonies and a lot of our teachings under the night sky. And then we also look at astrology as not only ceremonial and participatory, but we operate from a mythic perspective in that we see that the cosmological cycles, if we participate in them consciously and ceremonially, we are, in fact, aided in that participation. So, in other words, we become inspired. And when we participate by actually observing the cycles of the planets and the patterns of the constellation, we are directly involved in that as above, so below mystery. And then we also look at the archetypes. So along with that mythic perspective is the link between a modern psychology and archetypes. And, of course, ancient shamanism used the gods, goddesses, the spirits, the animal essences. And there were also many astrologers and psychologists from Jung to Dane Rudyar to Sylvia Pereira to Jean Shinoda Bolen, who also look at a full spectrum of the archetypes. So we see the planets, the constellations, the sections of the sky as archetypal possibilities, as a non-hierarchical cross-section of all the archetypal possibilities. And the chart is the, you could say, the archetypal blueprint, the archetypes that we carry. So, and then the other, another piece that I think is really important, a couple of other pieces. One is that we value the totality of all human experience, including the light and the shadow, evolution and involution, death and rebirth. And we also especially value the divine feminine. And as Gary spoke of the circle of the grandmothers, this is something that we feel with Venus and her collective cycle, which I won't go into, but she's in a collective cycle right now that ends next August. And it's really integrating Capricorn, which we see as originally having been the circle of the grandmothers, represented the Earth Mother as circle of the grandmothers, but it's been co-opted by the good old boys network and patriarchy. So we're returning, you could say, Capricorn to the circle of the grandmothers through shamanic astrology.
So connected with shamanic astrology is also shamanic breathwork. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that and how it differs from other kinds of breathwork.
Well, shamanic breathwork actually comes from Stan Grof's work, Stan Grof was one of the, he was one of the fathers or founders of transpersonal psychology, which is my love. And so it's about third generation from Stan Grof's holotropic breathwork. It's similar. And we do recognize some of the shamanic principles, again, of as above, so below, as within, so without. Hold on, my phone decided it's going to go off. I don't know. These iPhones are very strange. All of a sudden, they start talking to you. It's just the weirdest thing.
Right.
Anyway.
Speaking of patriarchy.
Yeah. Right. Like, how did you get turned on there? So we look at the breathwork process rather than having a therapist who is guiding you or involved in your process in any way. We look at the shamanic breathwork process as being connected to the shaman within, to the healer within. And so that experiential wisdom and the healing that can come from that kind of altered states work, it is altered states work, is very much a part of an individual's inner experience, not even the experience of the group, but an individual's experience. And that the breath functions as a bridge, really, between the body, the mind, the heart, and the spirit.
Right.
And it's journey work. So we won't be doing a really full, long process with shamanic breath work. We're just going to give our participants a taste of that work.
Right.
And we hope that it will be very, it will enhance our experience. And we may learn some things from our journeys about what we're actually doing. What we're up to in the Yucatan.
Yeah, and you know, one of the places that we're going to be visiting, as Gary mentioned, is Isla de Mujeres, or the Island of Women. And I'm wondering if you could just briefly tell us why you feel it's important to go there, what we're going to be doing there in terms of reclaiming the feminine for our planet and for ourselves.
Yes, you know, Gary talked about how we went to Isla Mujeres when we were in Cancun a couple of months ago, and I kept asking the question, so why is it called Island of Women? And no one knew. And it wasn't until we got home, we got, I don't know, three or four different answers, but they were clearly sort of, you know, somebody had made up something or put together some pieces along the way. So we did some research when we got home, specifically about Ixchel. It's I-X space, capital C-H-E-L. And we knew that she was a Mayan moon goddess, but she actually reigned supreme throughout the Yucatan in southern Mexico and as far as El Salvador for more than a millennium. So that's really interesting. She's also called the queen, our mother, the white lady, the goddess of becoming. And she's very fiercely independent, which, of course, stands well for the feminine. She allows no one to own her. She's free to come and go as she chooses. So strong feminine. She's also a fertility goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an add-on. We just felt that, wow, you know, she's not being honored. People don't know who she is. I'm sure there are many who honor her. I was actually looking for a figure or a statue of her in some of the shops, and I found one that I think was, how much was it, Gary? Like $3,000 or something? It was amazing. It was beautiful. It was made from obsidian, and of course that's the one I wanted, but, you know, I was not going to pay $3,000 for a little statue. But the rest of them I didn't really care for, but this one was really beautiful. And we just felt that, wow, we could really do a wonderful thing by going to the island with our group, since we have to come back to Cancun anyway. Just take a day trip over, get to her ruins, which we did not get to. Apparently there was a storm that destroyed her temple. And especially when Gary did the research and found that there were many small figurines of Ixchel all over the island when the Spaniards arrived, we thought, what a great thing if we could go to the island and honor her and do some ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we want to do some ceremony. I'm a high priestess, so I don't know how it's going to look yet. We'll all participate, and I'll facilitate, and we'll feed her, and we'll honor her, and we'll call her back to the island on behalf of the divine feminine everywhere.
And on behalf of
our
planet.
That's our idea at this point.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for that, Anya. And I just want to put in my little piece here toward the end. As most of you know, I'm a storyteller and drummer. And one of the stories that I'm thinking about sharing on this trip, I'll have a little bit of time to kind of do my thing. And I want to just briefly share one of the stories I'm thinking about telling. You know, in almost all indigenous cultures, the belief is that we come here bearing certain gifts that we really don't know how to offer the world. So we need the community to help us discover and unpack those gifts. And for this reason, indigenous cultures have devised rites of passage or initiation rituals for young people that help them discover and utilize their gifts. And as I've said many times before on this show and in my work, the collapse of industrial civilization is a kind of planetary initiation that we've created for ourselves in order to discover our gifts and discover how to utilize them in this time of demise. So I'd like to share a story from the Mayan tradition. It's a story of a young man named Poder. And Poder means to have power or to be able or to be empowered. I usually tell stories with a drum, but since it's pretty challenging to do that on the radio, I decided to just tell it without the drum. So I'm using the version of this story that my friend and mentor Michael Mead tells in his 2012 book, Fate and Destiny. So it goes like this. Once upon a time, a woman in a particular village was about to give birth to her first child. Because she knew the birth was coming quickly, she sent a message to the midwife to come as soon as possible and help her. The midwife and other women came to help the mother, and the contractions became stronger and stronger, and the woman gave herself completely to the birth. In the throes and upheaval of the birth, no one noticed the crowning of the baby, nor did they notice that the boy came into the world with certain gifts. According to the myth, the boy entered the world wearing a green cloak and carrying a gourd full of water. The midwife immediately took these and put them away so that no one would see them, and then went back to help the mother. It was a normal birth, and the mother and baby were in good health afterward. Meanwhile, word went out to the village that the woman had given birth to the boy, and everyone wanted to see him because they knew that each child is born with a gift to the village. Several days after a naming ceremony was held and people came bringing food and gifts, the child was named Poder. In those days, children were not perceived as yet another burden for the family, another financial obligation, but rather children were seen as little gift givers. Nevertheless, the people did not yet see the gifts of Poder, and in a few days the midwife took the green cloak and the gourd that Poder brought into the world out beyond the village to a place called the Holy Hills, and she gave those to some people who lived out there. She returned, life went on, and the boy went through all of the ups and downs of childhood. He had his good days and his bad days. He loved, he was abandoned like everybody else. But one day, as he entered adolescence, he began to question, and he asked many questions to the people of the village and to his family. For example, he asked, "Do I have something to give this world, and does this world have something to give me?" No one was able to answer his question, but he had been told that the midwife who helped him bring him into the world was a very wise woman. So he went to her and asked, "What do I do with these burning questions?" And rather than saying, "You must go to college," or "You should see a therapist," or "Why don't you join the revolution or the army?" she said, "You must go out into the holy hills and carry your questions there to the world." So Poder took leave of his family and headed for the holy hills with nothing but a bit of food and water given to him by his mother. And after a while, he had no food left, and all he carried with him were his questions. While wandering, Poder encountered some people who were doing rituals and who welcomed him warmly. They asked him why he was wandering the holy hills, and he told them about the questions he had carried and that he longed to know the answers. Did he have something to give the world, and did the world have something to give him? The people listened and answered that both things were true. After they all shared a meal, the people brought forth his green cloak and gourd that had been his birthright and handed them to him and explained that he had been born with those exact gifts and that it was now time for him to learn the meaning of them. Poder was introduced to a person who had similar gifts, and he learned that those born with a green cloak and a gourd of water were destined to become rainmakers in this part of the world that was so hot and dry. So to be able to bring rain was not only important, but could be a life-saving experience for everyone. Poder was a good student and paid close attention to his teachers and the lessons for understanding the use of his gifts. Eventually, he became able to roll up into the clouds and loosen the waters that held the gifts. He learned how to handle his gifts and how to protect them, when to use his talents and how to be ready to participate in life and give his gifts to the world. So soon enough, it was time for Poder to return to his village, and he took leave and thanked the people who had received him and given him back his gifts. Back home in his village, he began serving the people there, helping bring down rain to the earth so the people could grow corn and beans and squash. And the people recognized that he was using his gifts to benefit the community, and soon he became a favorite son of the village. Now, naturally, there was another youth in the village who had no idea how to use his gifts, and he began following Poder around in order to learn where he kept his gifts and how to observe Poder and try to become the same kind of rainmaker. Unfortunately, one day Poder was busy, and the other young man went to where Poder had hidden his green cloak and gourd, and the young man began to imitate the motions Poder had used to roll up into the clouds. He was able to do the same thing, and the clouds began to rumble, and rain started to fall from them and onto the earth below. The people were glad to see the rain, but the young man who stole the gifts had no idea how to use them. A small, gentle shower became a downpour that grew into a huge storm, and the storm became severe hail and lightning that damaged the crops in the field, and eventually all the crops were washed away in a flood that threatened to consume the entire village. The people say that the god had become angry at the misuse of the young man's powers, and they say that the god finally stopped the rain and knocked the false rainmaker back down to the earth. Thereafter, Poder was able to reclaim his gifts. The people eventually restored the village and planted new crops. However, after these terrible events, people say that no one, not even the midwives, had the ability to perceive the gifts that children bring into the world when they are born. Because we are descendants of those people, most people do not know what their natural gifts and powers might be. The people of Poder's village and their descendants say that the God-given gifts of most people remain hidden, and few know what they are intended to give this world. Many people live their entire lives without knowing. That is why they say so many people imitate what others do and become envious of those who find their gifts. Thus, many people rise to the top without really knowing what their gifts are or how they were intended to use them to serve the world. As most of you know, in recent weeks on this show, I've been emphasizing our gifts and how we can utilize them at this time. We can't discover and use those gifts in isolation. Like Poder, we need people in the community to assist us in finding and sharing them. And perhaps our journey to the Yucatan Peninsula will be a bit like Poder's journey to the Holy Hills. Perhaps this journey will teach those who make it a bit more about their gifts and how to use them. Gary and Anya and I are hopeful that all of you will join us in February, or as many of you as possible, for this golden opportunity to learn about the culture from which this story came, to connect with the beauty of the land and people, to rest, to have fun, to connect with other members of the tour, and to restore your spirit. Gary, would you tell us one more time how people can register for the Indigenous Heart Tour? We have just a couple minutes left.
Yeah, they can go to yours or our Facebook, any of our Facebook pages, Anya's, mine, yours, and they can see a link that takes us to the website for the Yucatan Peninsula Sacred Site Tour, and then go to fullmoonsanctuary.org/Yucatan-2015.htm, and they can go there and they can get my phone number, which is also 206-779-5870, and they can call me and I'll get them registered and get them ready to go.
And don't we have a special, Gary, right now?
We do, yeah. Thanks for reminding me, Anya. Thanks for reminding everybody. We're in the midst of our early bird special, and the price for this all-inclusive tour, including all of our food and pretty much everything that's included in the trip except for the air transportation, is only $1,590. This is for 9 days and 10 nine nights and 10 days, and that's really a great price, and that's only good until the end of this month. And, you know, once again, I want to reiterate that we're already half full, and we're still 4 months out, so we encourage you to join us.
Thank you so much, Gary Stamper, Anya McAndrews, for being with us today and talking about what we can learn from Indigenous cultures that have collapsed, talking about this fabulous tour. As Gary said, this price is amazing. I've traveled in Mexico. I know that it is amazing, and so do they. And so we really, really hope that you can join us. Thank you for listening, and join us again next Sunday night on the Lifeboat Hour.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fit. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.